Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles: the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm very pleased to have with me today Professor Brenda Murphy. I'm going to give a short bio as usual because I think that it's very important that listeners should get to know the university's academics. Professor Murphy joined the University of Malta as assistant lecturer in 1994. She read for a master's degree and then for a PhD at the University of London. In 2009, she joined the De Bono Institute for the Design and Development of Thinking, becoming its director. She was responsible for running the Masters in Creativity and Innovation and the International MSc in Strategic Innovation and Future Creation. In November 2013, the University Council approved the creation of the Department of Gender Studies, which Professor Murphy joined as a founding member. This was a team-driven exercise, developing a research master's in gender studies, a taught master's in gender studies, and PhDs in gender-focused research. Professor Murphy is engaged in projects such as the Global Media Monitoring Project as national coordinator. I hope we shall be hearing about that during the program. Cost actions and other EU-funded projects for the European Institute for Gender Equality. 2017, Professor Murphy was appointed associate professor. She is a past president of the Malta Academic Staff Association, UMASA. I'm going to ask Professor Murphy if I can call her Brenda.
Please.
Because we go back a long way.
Yes.
And I think it would be...
Let's not think how far.
better not. So this is clearly going to be a program about women in media. But as you correctly pointed out when we were discussing the questions, there are two main spaces in research around women working in the media and women in the media. So perhaps as a first question, if you can just sort of explain a bit what you mean by those two different separated areas.
Absolutely. The best way to think about gender and the media is to take a wide-angle lens and think about the two spaces, as you've just said, gender in the media and gender in the media, by which we mean women working in the industry and how they navigate their way through the organisations and where they are active and where they're blocked, where the glass ceilings and glass cliffs remain, where the pay gap issues emerge, where the lack of mentoring, lack of promotion, etc. They're the issues that you look at if you're looking at women in the media, in the industry. And then the other in is in portrayal and representation. So how are women portrayed in and on screen, in print, and in the digital world? So they're two very different spaces, but for me, I can't do one without the other. I have to look at both because they're both around democratization of space and they're both around equality and redressing inequality.
And I suppose that one sector, in a way, bleeds into the other, in the sense that if you've got administrators and people who are running things behind the scenes, so to speak, that is going to have an effect on those who are actually in the media.
Absolutely. My favorite story, and I probably have used this for so many people who are listening, my favorite story is the story about the BBC when Greg Dyke took over as the director general. And he arrived in on a Monday and he was told, Monday mornings we have this big meeting and everybody has to process a half foot of paperwork in preparation for this meeting on a Monday. And he said, well, that means everybody has to work on a Sunday. And they all said yes. This is the executive board. And they said yes. And he said, well, let's move that Monday meeting to Tuesday. So everybody has their Sunday off and comes in Monday and prepares and has this really important meeting on Tuesday. And for me, that is encapsulates how a simple thinking around, in this case, work-life balance, changed everybody's lives. significantly. So the people who are working on Sunday certainly had time with their families got time with them. People came in fresh. They valued the fact that they were given time to work within their work time. The meeting just needed to move from Monday to Tuesday. Nobody died. In fact, it was better. It was positives all around. So that's not a gender example per se, but in some ways it is, because a lot of men end up working at home, because a lot of men are in decision makings in media organizations, as we know, because it's an inverted triangle where all the men are at the top and all the women are at the bottom. And we have the stats to show that. You go to the European Institute for Gender Equality's website and look up the Malta data, which we gathered in 2013. You can see where women are in decision-making in boardrooms, etc. So what Greg Dyke did was he gave, in this case, men, a chance to have a better work-life balance. So he was thinking from an informed space, and a very tiny adjustment, like a chiropractic adjustment, made a significant difference to everybody's life. When women go into organizations and bring with them their lives, their messy lives of being caregivers and the responsibility of being a caregiver and seeing the world through a different lens, seeing the world through a lens where they know you can't walk to your car in safety at night in a dark place without anxiety, because that's the world women live in, then they bring all that to the table. So they'll sit and talk about, well, are we having the meeting during daylight hours, or, you know, and where can we park our cars, and who's, can we finish by four, because everybody has to pick up their kids, not just the women at the table, the men too. So they bring with them their lives and the demands of their lives, and they alter the workspace to become a reflection of what's needed for everybody to be, to have better lives. And with that, there's so many other, obviously so many other benefits, because they'll then bring in informed decisions about things like programming. And if they're non-patriarchal thinking women, which sometimes women are, they'll challenge the kinds of programming that are happening, the types of recruitment that is happening, the types of decision making that's taking place. And they'll alter that as well. So very subtly, but very profoundly, you'll get a change in the work culture.
This is something that I've been discussing with various people over the last weeks on these programs, and these two issues keep cropping up, so to speak. The importance of changing sociocultural norms and also appreciating the diversity, even in something like engineering. You know, when I've asked, you know, what do you think it would bring to the table if there were more women in engineering? And the answer is diversity. They're coming from a different angle, and that can only be of benefit.
To half the population, if not all the population.
Exactly. Yeah. So you obviously do an awful lot of research. I looked through your references, which I needed actually preferably about 2 weeks to check out, which I obviously did not have. So perhaps you could talk about the research that you've been doing in these last years, obviously. And I think you're suggesting the FM committee.
Yeah, well, there's a list. I had sent you a list of diverse research, just to give listeners an idea of how beautifully patchwork and different and diverse the area is as a space for research. I sent you probably just the last year or two of my more recent research. And as I was looking through the list myself, I was thinking, oh, wow, yeah, it's true. I'm so lucky. I get to do all of this different stuff. So, for example, the most recent pieces of writing that I did, the first one was around media landscapes and striptease cultures. I love that title. And it was around patriarchy and portrayal and bodies. And that study was looking at how advertising objectifies women. Now, we've heard this lots of times. We're tired saying it, and we're tired observing it, and it still happens. And this piece was actually quite therapeutic, because I got to talk about the fact that it's still happening. And I was able to give contemporary examples of, yet again, how the media, especially advertising, is sometimes subtly, but most times not, reproducing images of women that are damaging. Damaging to women, damaging to men, damaging to everybody. Because it sets up an unrealistic expectation of what a woman should look like, and what a woman should be, and what a woman should do. So it's bad for women because they think, I should be like this, and it's unattainable. Completely unattainable, because most of the images that we see of women are women who are either photoshopped, or they have undergone surgical alterations. So the women we see are not attainable women. So that's bad for women, but it's also bad for men, because men then see the same ideal and look to the women around them and say, well, you're all falling short. So it's really, really bad for everybody. it doesn't lead to meaningful relationships and significant relationships because it becomes about the ideal body.
Does this happen to men a bit as well, or not to such a greater degree?
It happens to men a little, very little. It's not good for it to be done to anybody, first of all, but it isn't systematically constant and present all the time for men, and it is for women. And you step outside of this radio station and you look around at billboards, you look around at the way radio producers talk, you look at the way presenters talk in the morning shows on drive time. It's unintentional. It's all part of the patriarchal script that none of us interrogate. So it just gets repeated and repeated and replayed and reperformed. And so it's very hard to extract it, but it's present. And so, no, I don't think it gets done to men the same way as it gets done to women.
What about the statistics? Because I think it's interesting to look at statistics. I'm not asking you to reel out details. But on the whole, talking about women in the media and women in the media, where do we stand vis-à-vis gender equality?
Oh, God.
Let's take Europe.
That's a big one.
Let's take Europe.
With regards to gender equality?
Equality, people in radio, for example. I mean,
okay. Oh, you mean presence?
Yeah.
There exists. Well, the best source to go to for that, to give you a really good snapshot, is the Global Media Monitoring Project, which is a nice segue. The GMMP is an amazing, amazing project. It started in 1995, just after the charter was signed post-Beijing, the last big Beijing conference, where women and media was one of the major spaces, outcome spaces, that had to be examined and explored. And this charter was signed into by most globally. So what has been happening since 1995 is every 5 years, it's a longitudinal study, it's data, it's heavy, big data. Every 5 years, around the world, there's a national coordinator in each country. I'm the national coordinator here in Malta. And we work with the Broadcasting Authority and with students usually. And we take a snapshot, a 24-hour snapshot of news. Now, this is just news as a format. It's not advertising, it's not film. So bear in mind, it's just one very narrow space, but a very important space, because news, representation of the news, is keeping your finger on the democratic pulse of a country. So how women are being represented and their occupation of space in media production is a good reflection of the democratic process of that country. And the bad news, the really bad news, and it's not just about Malta, it's global. When we carried out this research every 5 years, the last one was in 2015, the differential between 2010 and 2015 was zero. There was no improvement between the figures in 2010 and 2015. And the figures were that 24% of women appear or work or are present in the news, either as subjects or as reporters or as journalists or as producers or as victims. And when women do appear in the news, they're more likely to appear as victims, or if they're political voices, they're usually stereotyped in around feminine political spaces. So they'll be reported as experts around family, around health. So when women do appear, that 25%, they are very much boxed in into very narrow boxes.
The caring issue.
The caring, the soft journalism, soft media. So yeah, that's a snapshot, if you like. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the Global Media Monitoring Project has been phenomenal. It's led in Europe. It's longitudinal, as I said, since 1995. And Malta has been involved since 2000. So we've been gathering, and there is Maltese data available. If you go to the Global Media Monitoring website, you'll find Malta as a case study, because I've had to do the reports through summer every 5 years and wept over them. Wept over them because of the data and how depressing it was. So what we will find is that since 2000, 2005, 2010, 2015, and now coming up 2020, the picture in Malta has been and continues to be captured. So you can get the raw data from there if you need it.
That gives me a bit of another segue into the question of the EU. Let's just take Europe for now. That's in the little bit of reading that I managed to do, and in that extremely interesting video that I was with Claudia Padovani and
Karen Ross.
Karen Ross, yes, sorry. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. They were talking about the regulations that had been successfully put in place in the EU that have now become law, directive, within the directives of the EU, which look very, very good on paper.
Yes.
But their complaint, in a way, or their comment at the end of the day was, that's wonderful. I mean, great step ahead.
Significant.
It's very significant. I mean, you have to have that basic law there, the regulations, otherwise it's hopeless. But in actual fact, has this turned into a change in reality?
Good question. And I'm sure if Karen and Claudia were here beside me, they would be nodding their heads and agreeing and then crying again. What I've been seeing and watching over the years is that we've had great, great shifts in ensuring that legislative changes have been made and policy changes have been made or proposed. And I do believe that legislation drives change. But legislation without enforcement is an empty can. And unless you have enforcement actually happening, then the legislation is only worth the paper it's written on. And I'm not sure how rigorous enforcement takes place from EU down as a trickle down to each country. I'm not sure how the directives have been passed on, the baton has been passed on, and how seriously it has been taken when it is passed on to each of the countries within the EU.
I'm very keen on NGOs. I'm an NGO person myself.
Yes.
And I think that there is one way, perhaps, of pushing that agenda. Once those regulations are in place, it is with advocacy within the NGO sector.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm sure there are NGOs.
Is that my next segue? I think
absolutely.
It probably is.
Yes, continue.
Okay, thank you. So you're quite right. And in fact, one of the gaps that we have here locally on a national level is that we do need activism and advocacy in this space. And you're quite right. NGOs are the solution to that problem. And over the last few months, and certainly while I was on sabbatical, I was able to incubate this quite a bit and rest enough to decide I had the energy to do it. So I have decided that it was time for Malta to have an NGO that was focused on media and gender. And I've been very lucky in that I've been able to bring in a couple of people whom I know are as passionate and energized about the topic as I am. And very soon, in fact, in probably the coming days or weeks, we will be launching a media and gender platform here in Malta. It's going to be called Mediating Women. We spent a lot of time thinking about the name.
It is excellent.
Thank you. So its focus is to balance the media, and it's going to be a platform for inclusive discussions around women and the media.
And who will be invited on?
Anybody who cares about the media and gender is welcome, because the more voices we have, the better. So we're hoping that people from industry will become involved and wish and beg to join us. We're hoping that other academics, researchers, I have PhD students that I know are going to add so much to this and bring so much to the table. And there are policymakers that I suspect might be interested in taking part and helping us to help them. That's about to happen.
Yes.
That baby's about to get born.
This series is aimed at celebrating women on campus as an anniversary series. And obviously we're discussing issues that are pertinent to our students on campus and our academics on campus, and also for our students who will then move away from campus. Some of them might remain as academics, some of them will go on to do PhDs elsewhere, and they are going to come up against or find these challenges as they go out. So what I'm very keen to do is to find experts like yourself who can anticipate those issues for the students who are going to find that situation within their own workplace. So this platform should really help.
I hope so. It's going to have several tasks. It's going to be educational. We're going to use it to hold research. It will be an activism space, advocacy space, watchdog space. So if we see a piece of advertising or a manual, which is what we've been seeing lately, well, we've been seeing forever, manuals are where a panel is mostly made up of men or all men. We see that a lot. In Ireland at the moment, there's a fantastic Twitter space called Manals. And when people see one, they report it, and then a little more is made out of it. So it's putting pressure on the producers and organisers of programmes to think before they produce yet another Manal, because they'll be shamed. So it's that kind of activism that I'm hoping this NGO will take up as well. So it'll be creative, it'll be a little bit energised, it'll be a little more than just writing letters to the editor saying, no, 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 this is not good enough.
One of the issues that I have actually discussed with other people is the gender pay gap.
Yeah.
And I think that this is something that I was surprised when I discussed this with an expert, that the more educated you are, the higher sort of level that you're working at, the worse the gender pay gap becomes, which I found slightly counterintuitive. Because I thought people with a sort of better standard of education would be aware more, perhaps, than somebody who doesn't. But it seems that this is not the case. And we've seen this, obviously, famously recently in the BBC, where a foreign correspondent, I think, was so incensed by the fact that she realized that she was being paid 50% less than her colleague doing similar work,
yes.
Actually resigned.
Yes.
So what do you feel about that? Is that something that can be shouted out?
Yes, it can, it should, it is. It needs to be shouted out more by men and women. One of the ways we can counter the pay gap is transparency. And when I was involved with UMASA, I was conscious of the fact that transparency is the only way for us to know and fight. Because if there's transparency, then you can't, your employer can't be paying a man more than a woman. There are other ways that men can get benefits over women, even when there's transparency, so it's not the absolute solution. But certainly if there's a schedule written down and everybody knows that this job earns this money and this job is paid this money, then everybody should be coming home with that sort of money in their check at the end of the day. The other way we can shout it out is by having the high visibility moments that are happening within the media. So the media has got its power. We know this. The media is phenomenal in its power. And when the media reports on itself, it's even more exciting. So, for example, one of the other pieces I wrote this year was around couples and framing couples. And it was an interesting piece because it brought me to a place I never thought I'd go, which was a positive respect for the media. I was looking at sitcoms and how sitcoms portray couples. And it became a very positive piece about how important humor is for us, for our well-being, and how coupledom is important to us, good coupledom is important to us for our well-being. So if you're in a good, positive relationship that's supportive, you're at your best health. And when we are exposed to comedy, it increases our endorphins and it brings us into a space of good health. So well-being was ticked in both of those boxes. So I married those two together. And I was looking at how couples are portrayed in the media, in sitcoms. And I decided not to be too narrow in my definition of couples, be as non-heteronormative as possible. So I started off by looking at The Odd Couple, and then I looked at a whole series of American and British comedies in between, and I ended with Grace and Frankie, and I gave longer to Grace and Frankie, because for me, Grace and Frankie has been one of those phenomenal pieces of media that has come out of the States. So when they do comedy, they do it very well. When they do good comedy, they do it very well. And this was a fantastic example of women being the starring role, older women being the starring role. But what was interesting in my research, so I was looking at deconstructing the texture analysis, if you like, of the sitcoms, but in my research I also came across the damning and sad news that Grace and Frankie had actually been paid less than two men in a similar sitcom as a parallel were being paid. And their co-stars, I can't remember the names right now, the men who were their ex-husbands and now had married, came out in sympathy. There was a threat of a strike, and it got resolved. We had a similar moment when, say it for me, The Big Bang Theory. It started off with three boys.
Yes, I remember.
They were being paid $1 million a week. But then as Penny and the other two characters, Amy and Bernadette, came in, it became significant and became as important as characters. It was discovered that they were earning less. And what the guys did, in a very strong statement, came out and said, we are going to take a pay cut so that the three female stars can be brought up on parity with us, because we will not tolerate a pay gap.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, what should have happened was the producers should have stepped forward and said, actually, everybody's going to get the same amount and we raise it. But this was a very powerful gesture.
Because it was such a popular show, I'm sure they weren't short on cash.
And it couldn't have happened without those three women.
Definitely not. I imagine many a PhD will be written on Friends.
Yes.
Already, probably.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Dealing with these issues as well.
Yes.
We've come a long way. We've just got 2 seconds to finish this. Do we have a further to go?
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. Yes, we have. We have to make changes around media education. We have to teach media literacy. We have to make changes around media content. We remove the stereotypes, commit to gender equity programs. We have to continuous in-house education for journalists, for students, for staff. We have to look at media organizations and address how they're working and their internal values, and how we can help and support and remove the sexism, et cetera, that takes place within the organizations. And we have to support research at a local and EU level.
Great. I knew this was a program that should have been an hour and not half an hour. I thank you very much, Professor Brenda Murphy, for being with us today.
Thank you, Patricia. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.